Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, the Senate votes today to increase funding to fight AIDS globally. But will the budget deficit and the war in Iraq make the president's original pledge impossible?
Also, buy or sell, investors ask, what would mega investor Warren Buffett do?
Warren Buffett now is pretty bearish on the U.S. stock market. He doesn't really see a lot of opportunity right now.
The California fires bear down on Los Angeles.
A judge tells a divorced Mexican-American father not to speak Spanish to his visiting daughter.
And Boston's Sugar Plum Fairy is looking for a new home.
These stories and more coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Bush is holding a news conference in the White House Rose Garden. He's blaming this week's deadly car bombs in Iraq on loyalists of Saddam Hussein.
We're trying to determine the nature of who these people were, but I will tell you, I would assume that they're either or and probably both Baathists and foreign terrorists.
He says he expects Syria and Iran to guard their borders and stop infiltrators from entering Iraq. The president says the United States is working closely with both countries to prevent this. The International Red Cross says it won't let outside pressures dictate whether to scale back its humanitarian efforts in Iraq. The statement follows yesterday's deadly attacks in Baghdad. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United States has been urging aid agencies not to give in to terrorists by pulling out of Iraq. Red Cross spokeswoman Antonella Notari says she understands Washington's concerns and why it is appealing to humanitarian organizations to stay.
What we have to say to that is we'll take our own decision based on our own thinking and on our own criteria. And we are not asking anyone, neither the coalition forces nor anyone else, to assist us.
Notari says yesterday's bombing, which killed two Red Cross workers, has raised a lot of questions. She says her organization is analyzing the situation and will determine whether or not its aid workers will continue to operate in Iraq. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Today in Iraq, a car bomb exploded near a police station in Fallujah. At least four people were killed. Southern California fire crews made major stands in the L.A. area and the San Bernardino Mountains, but they got mixed results. From member station KCRW, Eric Roy reports.
The massive flames of Ventura County's 90,000-acre Simi Valley fire bore down on the western edge of Los Angeles County last night. But Los Angeles fire spokesman Brian Humphreys says the use of a freeway as a fire break, the well-placed dropping of fire retardants, and hard work by ground crews paid off.
The fire itself has not spread into the city limits of Los Angeles.
But 100 miles to the east, the old fire that ravaged parts of San Bernardino made a run uphill and jumped Highway 18, which had been protecting the tinder-dry Lake Arrowhead Basin.
During the night, we sent an additional 50 engines up there to assist with structural protection.
U.S. Forest Service spokeswoman Candice Villapando says flames are burning several miles below Arrowhead, a favorite mountain resort. For NPR News, I'm Eric Roy in Los Angeles.
The Senate has approved Utah Governor Mike Leavitt as the new Environmental Protection Agency administrator. The vote supporting Leavitt was 88-8. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 56 points at 96.64. The Nasdaq is up 19 points at 19.01. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, policymakers at the Federal Reserve are deciding the future of short-term interest rates. Analysts expect the rates will stay the same at 1%. There have been reports recently of stronger economic growth, and that could spur the policymakers to nudge interest rates higher to ward off the threat of inflation. Economists warn other economic factors are still in play, like the weak job market. The Sony Corporation says it'll cut 20,000 jobs. That's about 13% of the Japanese company's worldwide workforce. The BBC's Jonathan Head has more from Tokyo.
There was a time when Sony was regarded as unbeatable in the world of consumer electronics. But in today's brutally competitive global economy, the company has lost its magic touch. The billion-dollar loss reported in April shocked investors, causing Sony's share price to plunge. Its more recent profit announcements have also been disappointing. By shedding such a large chunk of its workforce, the company hopes both to cut costs and convince investors that it is ready to embrace drastic change. Sony's difficulties have been caused by several factors. Its failure to foresee the success of flat-screen televisions, falling sales in its computer games and entertainment businesses, and the strengthening Japanese yen.
The BBC's Jonathan Head in Tokyo. A private business research group says consumer confidence rose this month. The Conference Board's index says consumer confidence rose more than 4 points. A spokeswoman says consumers were encouraged by signs of an improving job market. They may also be spurred to spend more money during the upcoming holiday season. That would help retailers. Consumer spending makes up 2/3 of economic activity in the United States. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
The NPR Shop introduces I Heard It on NPR, Shake These Blues, a compilation of blues tracks by musicians featured on NPR programs at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush pledged $15 billion over 5 years for the global fight against AIDS last February, thrilling many AIDS activists. But much of that money has yet to be appropriated. Well, the Senate is expected to vote today to boost U.S. funding for fiscal year 2004 for the worldwide battle against AIDS. The bill under consideration would mean that the U.S. would spend $2.4 billion on overseas AIDS programs next year. But that is less than the $3 billion many expected. We're joined from Washington by Dr. Judy Auerbach. She's with the American Foundation for AIDS Research. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, there's a global fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. What is that group?
That was something that was initiated with great support from the United States as well by the United Nations and others, and that is an attempt to bring resources from all over the world together in one place to then allocate out to countries, either governmental or non-governmental organizations or consortium of those that apply and articulate very specific programs for treatment and prevention.
And many people assumed after President Bush's announcement that the declaration of U.S. funds, those funds would be going to the Global Fund. Now there is tension between the Global Fund and the Bush administration. Why?
Well, I think that the Bush administration would say that there was never an absolute commitment that all international aid support would flow through the Global Fund. And what they are trying to do is come out with some sort of balance between monies that they'd like to spend in bilateral ways, that is just the U.S. with countries with whom it has a relationship, as compared with this global fund, you know, to which they'd basically have to surrender their dollars and let the fund figure out how those should be spent.
What percentage is going directly to, I think it's 14 countries, and what percentage of U.S. monies is going to the International Global Fund?
I don't know the exact percentage, but in this bill that's relevant that you're focusing on right now, the overwhelming amount of the dollars would be going to these bilateral efforts by the U.S. and a smaller proportion to the Global Fund.
So one key issue is who gets the money, and as we've said, the Bush administration would rather give it directly to countries. So the second question is, when do those countries get it and how much do they get? The administration is saying that it's a bad idea to give too much money too early, and that it never really promised $3 billion a year. What's their thinking there?
As you may know, the administration initially took the position that $3 billion in the first year of funding, that would be 2004, would be appropriate, but now it's deciding that $2 billion is more so, the argument being that many, if not most, of the countries that will be targeted don't have what they call absorptive capacity. That is, they can't receive the money and spend it efficiently and wisely because they don't have the infrastructure or the personnel to implement AIDS programs, especially around treatment.
And I know that the World Health Organization is arguing that, in fact, with that money now, you could build infrastructure.
And the UNAIDS has already said that, in fact, it's not a question of capacity. It's really a question of money. There are a number of places that have the capacity but simply don't have money to pay for AIDS drugs.
Doctor, as we've said, there are a lot of people who worry that the Bush administration might be reneging on the amount of money they give. Do you think that's ultimately going to happen? And is one of the factors the unforeseen cost of the war in Iraq?
I wouldn't go so far as to say they intend to renege on the promise. Of course, what's happened is we're facing this huge budget deficit in the United States and this added burden of cost of the war in Iraq. So the ultimate question is, where would the money come from, however much it is? And that, I think, is the biggest dilemma.
Yeah. And what will it come?
I think at least a portion of it will come, and a significant portion of it, because there's so much pressure and a promise was made. It may just not be as much as the rest of us would like. Mm.
Dr. Auerbach, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Dr. Judy Auerbach, Vice President for Public Policy of the American Foundation for AIDS Research.
Warren Buffett's the kind of investor you'd like to get inside the head of, especially if you're trying to invest too. He's made billions of dollars, and he's chairman and CEO of investment company Berkshire Hathaway, which has been valued at $115 billion. Recently, reporter Andrew Barry of Barron's Magazine sat down with Warren Buffett and got a chance to pick his brain, so we thought we'd pick Andrew Barry's brain about just that. Welcome, Andrew.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. You know, a lot of us, Andrew, these days don't know exactly what to do with our money, assuming we have any. Warren Buffett seems a little confused, too. He's hoarding some $24 billion, he told you, deciding what to do with it?
Yeah, I mean, Warren Buffett now is pretty bearish on the U.S. stock market. He doesn't really see a lot of opportunity right now.
Yeah.
And he's willing to sit on, as you said, about over $24 billion in cash, awaiting opportunities, whether they may appear in the stock, bond, or bond markets, or basically buying companies outright.
So what is he doing with his money, though? I don't imagine he can sit on it altogether. He talked to you about insurance.
One of the biggest businesses inside Berkshire Hathaway is insurance right now. They've been very active in that market, and that market has actually been pretty strong because in the wake of September 11th, pricing for insurance has been quite strong, and Berkshire's benefited from that. They're actually pretty upbeat on the insurance market right now.
Hmm. Andrew, so many people, both big-time investors and very small-time investors, got into the market. The market fell drastically. People still very tentative about it. How does Warren Buffett feel about the stock market right now?
I think his view is that it's fully priced in most stocks, and I think that he's finding it hard to find stocks that kind of meet his valuation discipline. I think he tries to buy stocks relatively cheaply, and there are not a lot of inexpensive stocks right now, given the rally we've seen in the market since the lows in March.
How about bonds? We've heard all sorts of advice on bonds in the past several months.
He's not crazy about bonds. Berkshire Hathaway sold about $9 billion worth of long-term treasury bonds in the first half of the year, and I think his view was that rates were at near a 30-year low, and there wasn't much opportunity in the bond market. So, and also junk bonds, which have been very strong in the last year. Berkshire had a big position in junk bonds last year, and I think he's not that enamored of junk bonds this year. So, unfortunately, I didn't come away from the meeting with a lot of great investment ideas, but I think Buffett's willing to be patient and wait till interest rates may rise or stocks may fall. I mean, whether he's right or not, we'll have to see. But right now, he's willing to be very patient.
Well, Warren Buffett, of course, sort of is Berkshire Hathaway, right. But he is 73 years old. Did he give you any hint as to what he plans to do when and if he leaves the company?
I don't think he has any plans to retire. I mean, he said in the past he'd pay to do the job. He loves it so much. And I think because he controls 30% of the company, he essentially calls the shots. I mean, I think he'll be on the job as long as he's physically able to do it. And he says he's in good health, and he appears to be very energetic and very engaged. And I think his mind is often on Berkshire Hathaway and what its possibilities are, opportunities are. I mean, he's still very much in the game.
Just to finish up, just on a personal note, what kind of a guy is he? What kind of an impression did you take away about
him? I was very impressed with him. He's very gracious. He's very, very energetic. I mean, obviously he's not a normal guy. I mean, most people aren't worth $35 billion like he is. But I think he makes you feel very comfortable, and I found him a very engaging and lively personality to be around.
$35 billion in just folks?
He still maintains some of his, Midwestern, kind of all shucks attitude. And,
yeah.
Some people will say that's kind of an act right now. He's kind of honed that. But, I mean, I think that it's legitimate. I think he hasn't lost some of his, down-home qualities. And I think if you read what he writes and hear him in public speeches, I think you can sense that he's still pretty grounded. I think that's part of the reason that he's been so consistently successful over the years.
He kind of kept his finger on some pulse. Andrew Barry, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Andrew Barry joined us from New York City. His article, The Waiting Game, appears in this week's issue of Barron's Magazine.
A Nebraska judge has ruled that a Mexican-American father cannot speak Spanish to his 5-year-old daughter, saying if you put the girl in a situation where people are communicating in a language she doesn't understand, that's not fair to the child. The case was filed by the child's Polish-American mother, who's been separated from the bilingual father since shortly after the girl's birth. The decision has caused an uproar in Nebraska, where the American Civil Liberties Union is considering legal action, and a state senator has filed a complaint with the State Judicial Review Committee. Ed Leahy of Nebraska Appleseed Center for Law in the Public Interest is one of those who disagreed with the ruling. Hi, Ed.
Hello, Robin.
Did the judge give any reason why someone could not speak, as he said, that Hispanic language at home with their child?
He seemed to agree with the mother that this would be difficult and traumatic for their daughter. And what he wanted to do, I think, was to limit that.
This is a custody case. So remind us, it's a visitation that the father's having with the child?
Correct. Because the father had been incarcerated for a number of years, he wants to reestablish relationships with his daughter. I think that the child in this case made a few comments to her mother that she might have felt confused or she didn't understand what was going on around her.
We should say the mother is saying that she's not opposed to her daughter being bilingual. She's concerned that her daughter is suddenly in a situation that's unfamiliar. According to the mother, the father's making the daughter call him dad in Spanish. It's just too fast. She didn't understand. He's making her eat Spanish food. And so there seem to be more issues here than on the face of it.
There probably are. And I think that in this case, the family would benefit more from going to therapy together, from learning about the culture together, from making those decisions in ways that are holding the child's best interest at heart. What I think the ruling, the danger that it sets, is that it values one culture over another and puts a limitation on what one can share.
I understand that the judge has said that the father can teach the daughter Hispanic words, but not speak fluently. There's a little bit of the transcript here. Let me read it. The principal form of communication better be in a language that the daughter understands, that she's learning from the custodial parent. That's English. Okay, says the judge, and the father responds, are you telling me I can teach it to her, but I can't speak it to her? And the judge replies, that's right. Your reaction to that?
I think that is where he overstepped boundaries, because, you know, visitation between a father and a daughter is not going to be a class to learn vocabulary and structured grammar, and that's not even the only way that one can learn about language or who one is in life.
Might the judge have a point in saying, you know, why don't you teach her the language first? Take your time. Could he possibly have been saying that, and is that all that unreasonable?
He may have been saying that, but he might have been better to say that by saying to the family, why don't you go and get some therapy and some work on a more personal level instead of legislating what is prohibited.
Mm. What's expected to happen next in the case?
Well, the judge has recused himself. Hopefully reason will prevail in this and a little less emotionality over the language issues, because that's a debate that is raging in our society right now, and especially in a state like Nebraska, where we've experienced tremendous growth in immigrant populations in the last 10 years, and people aren't comfortable with the presence of other languages. That's an American issue that we need to adjust to and realize that we're all global citizens.
Mm. Well, Ed, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Ed Leahy, coordinator for the Immigrant Rights Network at the Nebraska Appleseed Center for Law in the Public Interest.
Just ahead, the California fires now look like maybe the worst in the state's history. We'll check in.
And later in the program, move over, Arnold. Analysts say the governor races in Mississippi, Kentucky, and Louisiana are the ones to watch.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Wildfires continue to devastate Southern California. At least 13 people have been killed. Joining us with a report is Bob Martinez, information officer with the U.S. Southern Operations Center, representing state and federal agencies. He's in Riverside, California. Bob, what's the situation?
Well, currently we're tracking 8 large fires burning in Southern California. Since October 21st, we had 13 major incidents going at one time. There is some good going on. We were able to contain 5 of the fires. We're tracking 8 major fires burning right now. And in totality, we have burned 517,624 acres. For right now, for sure, it is the largest fire in the last 10 years. But if this thing continues, it'll may be historical in nature. We've had 1,389 structures burned at this time, and the situation is not good in relation to that. Where we did have an offshore wind, which means we had a sandy and a wind condition. Today and tomorrow, we're going to change weather patterns and go to an onshore wind situation, which is basically going to take some parts of the fires that were calm during the sandy and a winds and make those very active.
Bob, how much longer could Southern California burn? I know it's a tough question, but what's your guess?
I think that we're going to have some breaks in the weather. We're going to have a major weather change like we have in Southern California, probably around the end of this month and end of November before we can contain these fires.
Hmm. What's the sense of what's caused these spectacular fires this year?
Well, right now we're looking, unfortunately, it looks like most of the fires are arson-caused fires.
Hmm. Bob Martinez, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bob Martinez is with the U.S. Southern Operations Center in Riverside, California.
If you're in your 20s or 30s, there's a good chance you don't just have friends. You also have Friendsters. That's the fast-growing website that connects friends and then connects those friends to more friends and those friends to more friends and, well, you get the idea. It's 6 degrees of separation on a website. Here and Now visited a party in Boston recently to find out what Gen Xers think about websites like Friendster.
What I do on Friendster is check out other people, what they're into, and see whether or not they'd be good matches for people that I know.
Friendster actually has different areas where you can enter bits about your personal life, like what kind of music you listen to, what your interests are. But personality-wise, you really can't put that into a database.
I guess people must use this as a dating service, but I don't really see it that way. What I most enjoy is just clicking on random faces and seeing how I'm connected to them.
I think Friendster is also the great form of voyeurism because you get to poke and pry in other people's lives.
Well, our regular internet commentator David Weinberger is here to tell us more about the surge of interest in organized cyber social networks. Hi, David.
Hello.
Well, some of our colleagues are on this Friendster. First of all, how would you define it?
It's a social network. It's a website that functions as a social network.
Is it just like a dating service, or how does it work?
Well, Friendster was initially designed as a dating service, apparently, although they said you can use it for anything, of course. What happens is you register with them, perhaps because a friend invited you in, and you fill out a form that says what your interests are and where you live and so forth, and then you invite other people in.
Right.
And so now you have on your page a list of who you are and other friends in Friendster.
It's like the old phone commercial. You tell a friend, and they tell a friend, and they tell a friend. On the site on Friendster that we're on, you have pictures of your friends, and then you can click on any of the friends, and then they have pictures of their friends. But what's the purpose? Why couldn't you do that with your own email site?
Sites like Friendster and the others, no matter what their purposes are, and in Friendster it's maybe dating, and in others it's business contacts and so forth, are not so much about listing your friends, because you know who your friends are. It's about finding the friends of friends and friends of friends of friends. And so extending your social network to people that you wouldn't have known before on the grounds that friends of friends are more likely to be the type of people you want to be friends with than complete strangers are.
Right. You mentioned that people use it for business contacts. What are some other reasons to use it?
Those are the two big ones, because that's, business and social life are the big ones. But there are all sorts of little ones around, including one that the Dean campaign has put into beta, which I think is sort of interesting, called Dean Link, which is a Friendster. Friendster is supposed to sound to us like Napster, by the way, and that's where the name came from.
Mm.
It's like Friendster, but it's for local people who are working as volunteers volunteers for Dean.
Well, actually, let's have full disclosure here. You played a role in the Howard Dean campaign.
Minor. I'm an advisor to them.
This, in fact, is how many feel that Howard Dean has gotten the huge backing that he has through these Internet exponential websites.
What's interesting about Dean Link in particular is all the candidates will have or do have similar sorts of phone chains, except they're email chains of tell a friend and they tell a friend and we'll raise money. What's interesting about these social networks is that they're connecting the people who are on that chain to one another, not just your friends, but to getting connected to your friends' friends and establishing a network that way. It's different than chain letters, because now the people who are on the chains are actually connecting.
Interacting with each other. Well, you know, these networks, they don't replace real friends. Or is that possibly happening?
There is something odd about these networks, because one of the things, in my view, that holds social networks together, I mean real networks of friends, either online or in the real world, is how much implicit there is in those relationships, how deep and tangly and inexpressible real friendships are. With these social networks, you have to state everything. You have to state what your interests are. You have to state what who your friends are. You get a message from somebody saying, you know, Bill wants you to be his friend at Friendster. Well, that's a yes or no choice. I may like Bill, but not feel he's my friend. I want to kiss up to Bill or whatever it is. And I press yes as if there's only two choices in the world, friend or not friend. Mm. And it reduces some of the richness. And so these social networks to me feel much more artificial than real ones.
And there can be a lot of numbers. How many people, for instance, do you think use Friendster?
Friendster says it's well over 1 million have signed up.
Well, our friend who signed up now is getting an email saying she's connected to 101,762 people through her 25 friends.
And you have to wonder just how useful that is.
David, thank you.
Thank you.
David Weinberger, Here and Now's regular Internet commentator. For more on social networks, visit our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Arthur Gelb joins us about his new book, City Room, a treasure house of big city stories from his 45 years at the New York Times.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, residents of Kentucky will soon cast their vote for a new governor. Why are analysts nationwide watching so closely?
And her star was born when she took the stage at the last minute for an injured dancer in Don Quixote. A ballerina now prepares to make that her last dance as well.
I started with this ballet and kind of see it as full circle, and it'll be wonderful to finish with this ballet.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Another suicide bombing in Baghdad today. A car bomb exploded near a police station in Fallujah, killing at least four people. The attacks come on the heels of a series of car bombings yesterday, the bloodiest day in the Iraqi capital since the fall of Saddam Hussein. President Bush says the recent violence in Iraq is caused by elements of the former Saddam Hussein regime and foreign terrorists.
The Baathists try to create chaos and fear because they realize that a free Iraq will deny them the excessive privileges they had under Saddam Hussein. The foreign terrorists are trying to create conditions of fear and retreat because they fear a free and peaceful state in the midst of a part of the world where terror has found recruits.
The U.S. Senate has overwhelmingly confirmed Utah Governor Mike Leavitt as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Leavitt coasted to an easy confirmation after Senate Democrats softened their opposition while still lashing out at the Bush administration's environmental record. Leavitt has promised to promote a higher and more meaningful level of cooperation and the application of new technologies to protect the nation's environment. Firefighters have stopped flames threatening hundreds of homes in the Chatsworth section of Los Angeles, but in the San Bernardino National Forest, 20 structures burned overnight. The Southern California wildfires have destroyed more than 1,100 homes and killed 15 people. The AP's Monica Evans says evacuees are trying to stay positive.
Photos, documents, and a few small items was all they had time to gather. Now sitting in their cars and trucks watching the flames and smoldering hillside, they're just happy to have gotten out.
If the house, it can be rebuilt if it burns, you know, it's what's important is that we're all out and we're all safe.
You know, life happens. I got my horses out and my cats, and I figured, well, the rest is insured.
Red Cross centers have been set up throughout western L.A. County, eastern Ventura County with food and shelter.
The AP's Monica Evans. The trial of sniper suspect John Muhammad resumed this morning in Virginia Beach, Virginia, with some wrangling over the evidence. Court started with the defense objecting to the prosecution's plans to play tapes from 911 calls. The prosecution is arguing that defense lawyers are trying to sanitize the evidence. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are higher. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
So many states with budget problems right now, Massachusetts state senators have an idea to inject adrenaline into their state's economy. They want to declare a two-day tax holiday, which would temporarily lift the state's 5% sales tax on most, though not all, as we'll hear shortly, purchases. The idea is to reward consumers for continuing to buy through economic thick and thin, but it would cost the state $15 million. Along with the tax holiday, another $100 million in stimulus are also planned. We're joined now by Michael Widmer, who's president of the Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation. Well, welcome, Michael.
Nice to join you, Bill.
Michael, do you think this is a good idea?
Well, we've always been skeptical about these kinds of sales tax holidays, on the one hand. On the other, I think the argument for this one, and the one that at least makes it worth serious consideration, is it's part of a larger economic package that the Senate's going to propose later this week. It's $15 million out of a $100 million program that is really diverse and targeted. The House and the governor have other proposals. In that context, I think it's worth at least considering as one piece of it, but no one should expect that any of these proposals from the governor of the House or this particular one is going to somehow stimulate our economy in any meaningful way.
What's behind this? Is this a sop to the taxpayers by members of the Massachusetts Senate?
Well, I think it's a reasonable idea that the consumers have propped up the economy and nationally and here in Massachusetts, by and large, and this is a way of, as the Senate says, thanking them, if you will. On the other hand, it's not realistic to assume that this is going to pay for itself or that this is going to stimulate the Massachusetts economy in any meaningful way.
Yeah, I mean, far from pay for itself, it's going to cost $15 million at a time when the state of Massachusetts, like so many other states, is in big fiscal trouble.
Yes, and I think the main argument against this is the cost. I mean, $15 million would pay for a lot of the social services and rape crisis centers and so forth that are being cut.
Michael, do you see this at all from where you sit as part of a larger vision some have in the United States that cutting taxes cures all ills, raises all boats?
Well, there's certainly that common notion that somehow if we cut taxes and cut taxes and cut taxes, we'll stimulate the economy. I think there's very mixed evidence on that score. I mean, we had a higher income tax rate throughout the 90s, and we had a booming economy, one of the great economic booms of our lifetime. And so I think the notion that somehow cutting taxes will stimulate economic growth is vastly overstated. I mean, there's certainly some argument for that.
Michael Widmer is president of the Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation. Thanks very much, Michael.
Thank you, Bill.
Well, taxes are at the center of three important gubernatorial elections next week that are being closely watched for the insight they might provide into voter thinking heading into next year's presidential election. Over the next 3 days, Here and Now we'll look at the governor races in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Kentucky. Today, the Bluegrass State. Joining us from NPR station WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, is reporter Kim Cerise. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
Well, sitting Democratic Governor Paul Patton can't run again in Kentucky because of term limits, but also he's shrouded in scandal.
Absolutely. His political career is pretty much at a halt because of political campaign contribution issues. And also he admitted to an extramarital affair earlier this year. It's gone so far that Attorney General Ben Chandler has even indicted his chief of staff because of campaign issues.
Well, Attorney General Ben Chandler, is he the same as Democratic candidate Ben Chandler, who's now running for the office of governor?
He absolutely is. Ben Chandler is the Democratic candidate, and he happens to come from a long line of Kentucky politicians. But Chandler definitely prides himself on trying to not be tied to special interests because of his position as chief law enforcement officer in Kentucky, which is, you know, definitely a watchdog position.
But I understand that Republican challenger Ernie Fletcher, a doctor, I understand, is trying to tie Democrat Ben Chandler to the scandals in the governor's office.
He absolutely is. Fletcher is a doctor. He's a minister. He's also a fighter pilot and a U.S. Representative in Congress for Kentucky. And he's working on the time-tested strategy of it's time for a change, and he has pulled Chandler into the whole Patton mess and seems to be doing pretty well with that campaign strategy.
So change is the focus, and I understand there's been a series of debates, with the final debate being about how to raise money for what's really a cash-poor state. How do each of the candidates fall on that issue?
Fletcher has signed an agreement not to raise taxes in the state of Kentucky. Chandler has refused to sign this agreement, saying that the agreement means absolutely nothing, only what the candidate wants it to mean. Both are in support of tax modernization. Both have agreed to look at increasing the state's tobacco tax, which is the nation's second lowest at 3 cents. So basically, all in all, there is a lot of agreement there. But at the end of the debate, Chandler seemed to jump on Fletcher's bandwagon of it's time for a change. And I have some tape of the final debate, and Chandler, in his closing arguments, is basically saying whose change would be better.
Do we want change with an independent governor who has shown the courage to stand up against special interests, shown the courage to stand up against people of his own party? Or do we want a government by the special interests and for the special interests, which my opponent has a history of providing?
And in the next bite, with Republican candidate Ernie Fletcher, he is mirroring the change and also bringing in scandal.
We do need real change. We must clean up Frankfurt. And my opponent has been there for 12 years, 8 years the chief law enforcement officer, when we've seen the most waste, fraud, and abuse and scandal that any of us can remember.
So Republican challenger Ernie Fletcher is continuing to try to tie his Democratic rival to the governor, who, as we mentioned, is mired in scandal. But I understand that the Democrat is trying to tie the Republican challenger to Washington. Is that risky, considering that when President Bush made a visit to Kentucky, the Republican challenger raised a lot of money?
Yes, it is risky, but I don't think that the nationalization of this particular race is going to mean that much to Kentucky voters, because Kentuckians really want to focus on jobs at home, taxes at home, and things that they can do to better themselves.
Some other issues in the campaign, the possibility of gambling in casinos, drugs from Canada. But I also understand that animals have played a role in an ad campaign. A Norfolk Terrier plays candidate Fletcher in a Democratic ad, and a Russell Terrier plays Chandler in a Republican ad. Not to mention that the sitting governor is portrayed as a pig and yet another Republican flyer. So it sounds as if there's a lot of, drama to this campaign. But, Kim, do voters in Kentucky care?
Voters in Kentucky are beginning to take issue with this particular election. There has been a lot of political mudslinging. Kentucky does have one of the last, as far as I know, around the state. It's called the Fancy Farm Picnic, and it's basically a place where all political candidates can go and literally sling mud, and the audience stands there and screams back at them. So old-time campaigning is definitely alive and well in Kentucky, and voters are paying attention, but they're also approaching this with a sense of humor, because definitely the candidates seem to be approaching this with a sense of humor.
Well, Kim Cerise, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll keep an eye on this campaign. Kim Cerise, a reporter for NPR station WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky.
Still to come, a ballerina's story as she hangs up her pointe shoes at the age of 31.
You're listening to Here and Now.
We are all proud Democrats. And let me tell you something. November 4th is going to be a proud day for Democrats in the city of Philadelphia. It's going to be a proud day for Democrats.
That's Philadelphia incumbent Mayor John Street recently rallying supporters on HBO's pseudo-documentary program, K Street. But it would be tough to dream up a better TV plot than the real-world race for Philadelphia mayor, since a bug was discovered in the mayor's office October 7th. Bug, as in FBI listening device. It was part of an investigation into possible corruption in City Hall. The mayor's Republican opponent, Sam Katz, says the campaign has been getting back to normal since the FBI's cover was blown, which Katz says he's glad about, though he's now facing allegations of ties to corruption himself. Well, joining us to discuss the wild and woolly Philadelphia mayor's race is Angela Columbus, reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks for joining us, Angela.
Thank you, Bill.
Well, Angela, first, who's leading?
Well, if you believe the polls, it's Mayor Street by a slim margin. If you take into account everything, it would be about one percentage point. But it's a percentage point that his campaign argues puts him over the top and would make him win on November 4th.
Now, how long has he been mayor?
He's been mayor for the past 4 years, and he's now going for his second four-year term.
Is he being this close to Sam Katz at this point a surprise, and how much does it have to do with that FBI sting?
That's an excellent question. I think people have been surprised by the closeness of the race this time around. Philadelphia is a predominantly Democratic city, and you would think that a Republican would have a very difficult time making inroads. But a lot has been made about the fact that this federal probe has actually galvanized the mayor's base of support, in that they are now coming out in droves and basically making sure that people get to the polls.
Angela, who's Republican challenger Sam Katz?
He's been a businessman in Philadelphia for years, mm-hmm. and he's run for office several times, including for mayor in 99. And lost. He served on the school board back in the 80s. He ran for governor. And in between, he's been, running very successful businesses.
Now, he's got his own corruption scandal, possibly?
Well, it's just, it all grows out of a civil suit that was filed against him by several of his former partners, and basically accuses him of embezzlement. What you've seen recently in the papers is that there had been a bunch of documents related to the case that had been under seal, and they were released just yesterday. They were unsealed, and it basically sort of gave a lot more detail outlining the specifics of the case.
As voters go to the polls, both candidates are under the shadow of possible future legal problems, ongoing legal problems, right?
Well, it really depends. I mean, Sam does have this civil suit, and, you know, he believes and he has said that, it may go to trial, so that will be something that he would have to deal with. And as to where this federal investigation is going and whether it will implicate the mayor is anybody's guess. We've reported in the newspaper that the listening device was only in there for a short period of time, about approximately 2 weeks, and that it did not pick up any incriminating words. But what that means in the grand scheme of things is a big question mark.
Interesting race. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Angela Columbus is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She joined us from Philadelphia.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
After 35 years on the same theater stage, a sugar plum fairy has been sent packing, along with the Mouse King, the Dewdrop, and Fritz and Clara. The Boston Ballet's production of The Nutcracker is the most attended in the world, and this year's will take place as scheduled. But after that, it has to find a new venue, reportedly to make way for a more profitable touring production of New York's Rockettes. Oh, the indignity of it all. Joining us on the line is Valerie Wilder. She's executive director of the Boston Ballet. Hello, Valerie.
Hello, Robin.
Well, we know that the ballet has had financial problems. You've had layoffs and had a cutback on other performances. The Nutcracker at the Wang Theater accounts for 30% of your organization's operating budget. Last year you had rave reviews, but attendance was down, some 20,000 tickets. What happened?
Well, I think attendance was down actually for many things last year right across the country, including Nutcracker. The attendance was actually growing until last year. So, you know, it's a little early to say what the actual trend line is.
In fact, our Here Now theater critic Bill Marks points out that some traditions in holiday entertainment are changing. Audiences want to see alternatives to the Christmas Carol. There's anti-Christmas productions like Spiked Eggnog. And a lot of theaters have gotten desperate, and they're bringing in celebrities, you know, or star power for variety. Are you considering any of those things?
No, we're not. We think it's a really important holiday tradition. And don't forget that every year over 400 children from communities in and around the cities are cast in Nutcracker. And they experience the magic of performing in an ensemble. And it's, I think, a very community, family-based tradition that we wouldn't want to alter.
I can't help but remember my niece. I brought her. She was about three. And she almost stopped the production. She stood up and yelled out, "I am Yiddle now, but when I am bigger, I'm going to do that." What's the importance of this performance for kids to see?
For so many children, this is their first experience of seeing live performance on stage. And the arts. It's their first exposure to the arts. Well, and sometimes it's a life-changing experience.
Well, Boston's Mayor Thomas Menino says he wants to help find a new home. They're suggesting the Heinz Convention Center here in Boston. What kind of considerations do you have to make as you look at another venue?
Well, we have to consider all kinds of things. Will people want to go there? Will our production fit in it? Our production of the Nutcracker, for those who haven't seen it, is spectacular. It's beautiful, it's gorgeous, and it's huge, and it has all kinds of special effects. So we'd have to find a place where we can preserve as much of that as possible.
Well, Valerie, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Valerie Wilder, Executive Director of the Boston Ballet.
One favorite Boston ballerina is also leaving the Wang stage. Jennifer Gelfand is 31 years old and ready to retire. Gelfand has been dancing for Boston Ballet for 14 years, and this week she takes her final bow in the ballet that made her famous. Gelfand first stepped into the national spotlight in a true Star is Born moment as a teenager in Boston Ballet's Don Quixote, when she sensationally filled in at the last possible moment for injured dancer Laurie Young. Here and Now's Lynn Menegon spoke with her about that night.
I was actually sitting in the audience watching the performance I was scheduled to dance the following week.
I'm Laurie Young. I was a principal dancer with Boston Ballet for many years. We won't say how many. I was getting ready to retire with Don Quixote, and I was quite injured at the time. I had torn cartilage in my knee, and I couldn't lift my leg straight. I don't think they knew until intermission that I really wasn't able to continue. I was modifying choreography on the spot.
And after the first act, went backstage and get a drink of water and met the director on the stairs, and he said that Laurie Young was injured and was most likely not going to be able to finish the ballet, and go get my shoes on and into costume.
When I got off after one of the variations, I said, you'd better get somebody ready because it's going to freeze, and it did.
So down to the dressing room I went. You know, I really wasn't thinking. You don't have time to think. You just want to make sure your hair's done, some semblance of makeup, point shoes are there, into costume, and onto the stage. So I think if you have time to think about it, I think that would be worse, but it was such a whirlwind.
Jennifer, I think, was 17 or 18 at the time. She was Clara when I was Sugar Plum. And I remember watching her as a child. She was just, oh, get the kid out of here. She can do everything. Jennifer's fearless. She will try anything. It was a phenomenal technique. It is a phenomenal technique that she possesses.
Suddenly the ballet was over. and I had finished it. I certainly think, as you get older, you're not quite as fearless, but at 17 probably. I was young and it was easy and I was having fun out there, and that's what you do. When you're young, you're more focused on the steps and the technique, and as you get older, you focus more on the story. It's just taking care that you don't gloss over some of the truly important and small moments of the ballet. When you're young, you say, okay, you know, it's very methodical. You go here, he reacts, you do this. But when you're older, you take more care to make sure it's the right reaction, the timing's right, and the arms are right, and things like that. Started with this ballet, and kind of see it as full circle, and it'll be wonderful to finish with this ballet.
Okay. When is it time to retire?
I think it's different for everyone. You know, this was just felt right. I've got another wonderful second career, and I didn't feel like I had to continue simply because I was stuck.
Tell me about your second career.
I actually work at Gibson Domain Real Estate in the South End. It's one of the largest independent real estate companies, and I've been there about 4 years now.
Is there a parallel between dancing and selling real estate?
the reward when you find someone at home they love and they're so happy, or and you work with these people and succeed. It's similar to that feeling of satisfaction after a performance. I use many of those traits necessary in ballet. Dedication, commitment, perseverance, challenge are all part of the ballet world, and it's all part of real estate. And I believe that's why I've been successful thus far, and it's fun.
Come on, it's in. Come on. Chip, 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 chip.
What will you be thinking when you stand on the Wang Center stage for the last time? What will you do?
I don't know. I mean, it'd be sad, but I've had a great career, so. I don't know. I'll be bowing, hopefully.
Jennifer Gelfand takes her final bow this Thursday and Saturday. For more information, go to here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397.
Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Getting to your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news in these stories, Here and Now.
Move over, Arnold. Analysts say the governor races in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Kentucky are the ones to watch.
And Arthur Gelb visits with stories from 45 years as managing editor of the New York Times.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.